Good evening, everybody. We'll start with our motivation. So, right now in the world, there are over 50 million refugees, more than as many as any time since World War II ended. And we're coming into winter, and many of those people are in very dire situations, facing starvation, actually. And when we think about the state of the world, we have to find a way to keep ourselves open, receptive, and try to be helpful. So we need to engage both on the conventional level, and then we also need to find a way to come to long-term solutions. So if you just look in your own heart, in your own practice, you can see how this sense of I and me and mine is really a huge troublemaker, and the walls of protection come up, just as they do inside of us. They come up all around the world and everyone and create all kinds of havoc. So as we realize, as we look at the world situation, we can also put in relief our great fortune that we have to have stability of a roof and clothes and food, medicine, hopefully, and all of the situations that we need to live and then to practice. So let's make really good use of our time and seeing how what we're doing tonight is a part of this. It's a part of creating peace within ourselves and keeping ourselves open and receptive so that we can respond to people that we meet, to the situations in the world, our families, our communities. And then in the long-term goal here, we have to see that there's not a fix. And we need to actually extract ourselves from this situation. So as we go through this chapter 10, we want to keep in mind this long-term goal to help to relieve suffering by becoming fully awakened. Quiz tonight, and for the next few weeks, Venerable Children's in Asia, and we'll be doing this for about 4 weeks or so. So right now we're on chapter 10 quiz. Who do you think you are? Or maybe it's who aren't you? So the first question is, what are the main points of this chapter? And I thought just to kind of set the context, I'd say a little bit about the previous chapter, because that's where we really started this, the chapters in Aryadeva's 400 stanzas about ultimate reality. And so chapter 9, the way I termed it, was it's trying to see there's harmony of emptiness and dependent arising. And so external and internal phenomena arise dependently, and understanding their emptiness of existence by way of their own entities, our job is to grow wise in the meaning of the middle way, free from extremes. So this chapter 9 really starts the extensive explanation of the ultimate truth. And first it starts by refuting the true existence. And it does this by attacking and refuting permanent functional phenomena. So in chapter 9, it looked a lot at products. In this chapter, it's focusing on a permanent self and all these variations, and it just one verse after another is giving all of these different ideas that different groups have had about what the self is. So the heading of this chapter was the individual refutation of truly existent functional phenomena. So in particular, refuting the self. So truly existent functional phenomena. So what did people have for this? Anyone want to share what they came up with for this chap, this question? Question number one. The main points of chapter 10. Okay, I'll start.
Well, I think you just said it.
Yeah. Okay.
The chapter illustrates in many ways you see the self as permanent and then refutes it over and 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 over.
Okay.
Let us know that it's not.
Yep. So this chapter is pointing the eye at, we're going to refute a truly existent self or a substantially existent self or just a plain old permanent self. And in India at the time of the Buddha and afterwards, many schools asserted a permanent self. And this is similar to now. You know, the assertion of a soul is a type of permanent phenomena. Or in the Atman that they have in Hinduism. So these ideas are still here. So with this group of teachings, we have to see like this in all the teachings, no matter how complex or how simple they may seem, all of the teachings were taught for practice. So with these teachings, we're like looking in a mirror, and then we have to see where our wrong conceptions are. And so this particular chapter is the wrong conception of a permanent self. And so permanent means that something doesn't change moment by moment. So things that are functioning in the world, they arise due to causes and they cease due to causes. All of those things are temporary. They arise and cease and they don't exist for a second moment. And we actually know that we're impermanent, but we don't like to think of ourselves that way. You know, it's not so comfortable to see that there's something, you know, that's always changing that you can't really trust. So actually, this mirror is asking us to look, well, where am I doing this in my own experience? And that's what we need, that's what we want to do as we're going through this, is as you learn about the topics, we want to sit on the cushion then and find in our life where we're doing this. This is what it's about. It's not to stay up here, it's to come down to the heart. So we have that sense that I'm here always, you know, without changing, and we have philosophies that back that up. But when we really investigate, is there a permanent self or a permanent soul? All kinds of contradictions happen. And as we go through these different ones, you see things, they just don't end up making sense. But still, there's all these ideas around that there could be a permanent self. And so we go through this chapter to try to just examine in all the different ways that it could possibly happen. And some of them sound kind of outlandish, but actually a lot of them are ones that we actually hold. Yeah, so we have to, you know, we have to try to put ourselves into the verses and like who would have thought this and why? And then when you kind of go into that mind, you can see, oh yeah, well, I kind of thought about it that way too. Let's see. So the way we really kind of look at that is we say, could this exist? That's the thing. Could it exist the way they're talking about? And so something that's unchanging, that's permanent, not changing moment to moment, the big problem with that is that if it can't change, it means that it can't cause anything to happen. It can't be the result of anything either. So for things to change, you know, causes and effects to happen, change has to happen. So that's the big thing with things that are permanent. They're like frozen and static, can't produce anything. Can't be the product of anything. So as we go through this, make sure to take this back to the cushion and then see, who am I? Find what, how you're conceiving of yourself, and look at that and see if it's possible, the way you hold things. So that's how I see it. Because the chapter is to help us in our meditation. Help us to get rid of all these ideas, ones that are both innate and ones that are acquired. So the verse, summarizing verse in this chapter, which pretty much talks about what the chapter is about, says, through familiarity with meditating on the impermanence, suffering, and uncleanness of cyclic existence, abandon the limitless views of the self, both innate and those imputed by tenets. So we've gone, what that points to is that in the first four chapters we went through the four distortions, and then in the next chapters we looked at all our afflictions arise and things like that. And so now we're at the place where we want to look at all of these limitless views of the self and abandon them. So it starts off, now moving into question two, with the question is, what are the reasons why someone isn't inherently a woman, a man, or neuter? And so it's the way this question comes about is, I think, important to put it in its context. There was this fear that that when someone reached nirvana, they couldn't see this truly existent self. This is how this came about in the question. And so then they thought, well, then there's no self at all, because, you know, it just didn't make any sense. So then they said, oh, then let's just go for things that are conventional, because we can live with that, because this just doesn't add up. But then, and what they, so that was kind of the problem that they had. They were fearing that the self discontinued. They wanted to have this truly existent self, and then, but they couldn't see how that could ever happen at nirvana. So then there was like, well, let's just forget the whole thing. It's kind of really how I took it. So what was the problem there? So how does that relate to this verse? What was the problem? Like, how did they get from there to someone being inherently a woman, a man, or neuter? Do you know what the connection was with that? Maybe you didn't think about the question in terms of the text. Okay, so how did you guys think about the question?
So what I put was that some Indian Buddhists asserted two selves, an inner and an outer one.
Mm-hmm.
The inner is inside the body and it makes the sense organs engage with objects. It's the focus of the conception I.
Mm-hmm.
And the external is a combination of the body and sense organs which assist the inner self. And so, if the inner self existed by way of its own entity, then a woman would be a female in all future lives.
Right.
Yet this is not the case.
Right.
And one would always be reborn the same gender, if inherently a man or a woman. And the Vaisikas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, also asserted that the self has nine attributes that they listed, but gender was not included in the list. So that really showed that their logic was kind of full of holes.
Right. So there you had kind of part of the problem was they had the belief in rebirth, but they couldn't account for how someone could be a male and then be reborn as a female. Yeah. You know, and they actually, there was a lot of problems even with, which gets into the next question, with how you could assert their view that the outer person made the inner person. I think it was person, was that the word they used, or outer, maybe that wasn't the right word. Outer self and inner self. Yeah, outer self and inner self. So if the self doesn't exist by its own entity, if it did exist by its own entity, then it would have to go be male throughout every life, and that's they couldn't see how that could be. So then they couldn't figure out what to do with the self. So they just said, well, let's forget about it. Let's just stick with conventional. And they just kind of, that's how they, that was their solution. So the, so what the Aryadeva said about this, the inner person who is the agent and causes the sense organs to function doesn't exist from its own side. It's only out of ignorance that, and confusion that you would think that you are a male, female, or neuter. It's like fabricating something, like thinking that a rope is a snake. And so it's actually, we react to all of this. We believe we're male, female. I mean, we are at some, on a certain level, but we think we are inherently that. And then we create a whole, just like, the fears that come of thinking a rope is a snake, we do the same thing with the identity of male and female, thinking it's there in a way that it isn't. So this one verse, it was 2:26, refutes their particular idea of a self. Vaisheshikas, yeah. And then there was a quote from a sutra that said, an attitude of doubt foments poison, and though it has not entered one, one faints. And so this is the idea that we fabricate ideas based on things that aren't real, and we, even though they aren't real, we faint, like the snake. So we still react as if those things are real. And so one thing that the one way Venerable went about this is she said, well, okay, the Vaisheshikas were saying your body isn't male, female, or neuter. If you're saying the body, your body is male or female, exactly what are you saying in your body is male or female?
Right.
You know, what in it? You know,
it's could not it, the elements.
Yeah, could
the
elements?
Air, the water,
right.
The elements.
Right.
Well, the other thing too is that the way that I approached this question is that I just wanted to just shoot a whole bunch of holes in their thinking.
Yeah.
You know? And the other one was not only the one that Venerable Jigme said, that we would have to be these genders permanently life after life, but because if we were all females without exception, we would all look exactly alike and behave exactly alike, as would all the males. It's like there's no, because there's no change and because everybody's permanent, a female would be designated exactly this way. And everybody who was a female would look like
that. Like, like a cookie cutter.
Little cookie cutters. And the same thing with the males. So that kind of takes the whole thing about, well, you can't use those things to sort of subscribe the self to that particular way of thinking.
Mm. That's interesting.
I also wonder if somebody was one with maleness, all parts of the person, the mind and the body would have to be indistinguishable from male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It'd be one entity with.
Yeah.
That's a big problem. That's funny. So when they, from the introduction, it said, the self does not exist by way of its own entity, for if it did, it should be male, female, or neuter, but that is inappropriate. It's interesting to me that they have such a strong belief in rebirth, because it goes on, the inner self does not exist by way of its own entity. This is in their view. If it did, a woman should in future lives only be ever be a woman, yet change is observed. So right there, they're establishing that they're quite aware of rebirth in their worldview. So that takes us down to that male, female, neuter aren't attributes of the self. So one way they said it here, that, and this is actually, I think, you know, this is from the text, it said, femaleness and so forth are also not attributes of the self. Thus it follows that the inner agential person, like the agent, does not exist by way of its own entity. For when the inner self is neither female, male, or neuter, it is just out of ignorant confusion that you imagine yourself male. It's a fabrication, like mistaking a mottled rope for a snake. Okay, so what is your, how do you say that you're, that, how do you say, we're moving on to question three, on what basis are you saying that you're a man, a woman, or neuter? How does this contemplating that you aren't inherently, because we've kind of just thrown that out in the last one, but how does contemplating that you aren't inherently a woman, man, or neuter change your image or feeling about yourself? And can you imagine being another sex? So in the last question, we threw out the inherent female, male. Oh, but how is it that we designate? How is it that we are? How is it that someone is said to be? On what basis is someone said to be a woman, man, or neuter?
Simply determined. You know, there's an arrangement of, you know, the thing that's such a mind-blowing thing is that male and female, the bodies are made up of exactly the same components.
Mm-hmm.
And as Venerable says, it's just the mere arrangement of them.
Right, the arrangement of the similar
certain shapes, and then those molecules and atoms that perform functions in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what the real reason is on why male and female.
Yep.
I mean, that's just
arrangement of molecules. The
doing
tissues. Doing functions. So the verse that this came from said, when all the elements are not male, female, or neuter, how is that which depends on them male, female, or neuter? And so the Vaisheshikas threw it back to Aryadeva and said, you have the same problem that we do. How do you do this? And he says, well, we impute gender or sex in dependence on elements that lack inherent existence, so there's no problem from our side. So this thing of something being inherently male or inherently female is what gets things into problems. This is the whole thing, as Holiness was talking about in New York, that was so well said, of how there's, because we things are designated, there's room for all of this to exist. If you couldn't do it by designating, it couldn't happen. But the way, you know, it was kind of like that from the reverse direction that he was explaining, that was so helpful. Let's see. Then we'll have a little more to say about this. What about you is inherently male or female? A little bit difficult to pinpoint. None of the molecules are male or female. It's just how they're arranged. And we had quite a long discussion on this topic, though.
Yeah.
We went into
the culture.
The cultural things and hormonal things. And, you know, no one's saying there isn't a relationship and an effect on the hormones on the body and all that. That's certainly the case. But I think her point was how much we make of that. And what is causing what? Like, is the, you know, it's really hard to say sometimes, is the mind causing these physiological reactions in the body? Or did the physiological things happen first and then your mind went a certain direction? Mm-hmm. You know, she wouldn't really buy into that it was necessarily driven by hormones. That was kind of how the discussion went.
But if you imagine separating mind from the body, and try to imagine a male mind or a female mind,
right?
That becomes a whole different.
That's a very good one. Yeah, separate the mind from the body, and then imagine what would be a male mind and what would be a female mind.
Without the body, to identify.
Yeah.
Culturally identify with that.
Right.
Mind.
That's, I think, where the big problem is, and that's where I think that the Buddhist view of the mind being formless takes care of a lot of things, It makes you really wonder why things, even in the Buddhist world, don't function more with less gender bias, since we have this view. You know, it shows how strong the idea of, well, okay, let's say about this. This is what I became aware of. Can you imagine being another sex?
Oh, we have a question.
When I don't think about it, like, sure.
Yeah.
But then today I was thinking, well, I'm just thinking how much I've changed. Because when I was young, I didn't make these distinctions. Like when I was in elementary school, and I can remember getting quite upset when I couldn't invite my little friend over for a sleepover because he was male when I was in like fourth grade. I just thought, this is bonkers. Like, what's the deal here? And then I thought about it today, and I thought, wow, now I've had 60 years of conditioning, or maybe 55 since that time or whatever. And I was like, I have a few more views on the matter. Hate to say.
you know, what was very interesting, because when Venerable asked, how is contemplating it? So I spent a number of days thinking about this.
Yeah.
And it turned into this general category description, like I have brown hair, or I wear glasses, or I drive a blue truck. You know, if I could actually do that, to think that I wasn't inherently a woman, or how I'm so identified with it, is that I just thought, well, it could be just like a description of anything that I own or the clothes that I'm wearing. It would be such an aside that it wouldn't really matter, you know? So I kind of got it into driving a blue truck. Or, you know, yeah, it would be that simple to say. Well, you know, I'm a woman. I drive a blue truck. I wear glasses. I have a cat. I have, you know, one of those general descriptions of, to identify who I was.
It would just be another one on the list.
On the list of general categories.
But I think the reason it came up for me where it was more loaded is because I've realized since I moved here, that I wouldn't want to be a male in our culture. Mm-hmm. That's quite clear to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as there had to be women's rights and everything, and there's, you know, there's certain kinds of discrimination financially, and most of us have run into it. I have. I still think that the culture is, it would be hard to be a male in this culture. I wouldn't want to go through that personally. I'd rather be a female, the way our world is. So then I thought, can I imagine being another sex? Yeah, I can't imagine my body, but I wouldn't want to live in our society, particularly.
The thing that I thought about was in my life at certain times, for like Halloween, I dressed up as a male, mm-hmm. and then experienced a little bit of, because I looked really,
played the part,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even in that case and in that scenario, I was related to differently. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I got a very small taste of what that was, and so I couldn't really. I mean, I can say, yeah, I can imagine it, but really the experience that you would get would be so, like you said, loaded, or so really kind of huge to wrap your brain around.
Yeah.
I think it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing that I also thought about, there was a difference. I said it was kind of funny because I like to do things that most people would consider guy things.
Mm-hmm.
Like I like to run the chainsaw around here. I like to work on vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a lay person, I wore pants most of the time. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of funny that on one level, I never let being a woman sort of identify what I did, what I enjoyed as mm-hmm. well. I was a carpenter. Blah, blah, blah. But when it comes to having the body and the conditioning of that, that's where I didn't know exactly how I would be able to relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like the occupations that come with, you know, the male occupations. I've kind of broken through a lot mm-hmm. of those in my life, but having a body and what the expectations of culture of that, I think that's where I didn't know where to go with that.
Yeah, I too have had some experience. I was thinking about this with kind of role play situations, both in acting, so there's that aspect where you really have to take on the character, getting inside of it, but also in kind of a psychological role play structure thing where there were not enough men and I ended up playing the male from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to get inside that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it was edifying for me, which is I think the one reason I think I can now imagine being.
Because you needed the experience of really putting yourself in that.
The fake experience,
yeah.
But it was the intention of putting myself inside a male body and a male mind in order to just sort of look at the world through those eyes. Wow, this is really interesting.
Yeah, it would take that.
Yeah.
I think to even contemplate the question, really.
Well, I also had some questions came up for me after I thought about that, like what would I have done differently?
You know,
if I were a man, what different choices would I have made if I was a man?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the way my life went. Just go, instead of having it be Nancy, it would have been Ned.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what Ned would have done.
Yeah.
You know, if I would have been Brian, he, you know, my twin brother, my twin brother, what would I've done? But, which kind of was kind of fun to do. And, you know, in one part of my mind, said I wouldn't do anything differently. But another part, I said, boy, I could have had a lot more different. I would have had maybe a few more options.
Yeah.
Definitely a few more options.
Anyone else?
When I think about it, a lot of what comes up is this idea that whatever my mind gravitated towards the attractiveness or interest, I already have lots of things that come up that just kind of ingrained in me. Says you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to be attracted to that person. You're not allowed to be interested in this activity because you're male.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, being female would be a whole different set of things that were ingrained into me through society.
Yeah.
And that's kind of disappointing that that anybody's so limited in what they're interested in because of that.
I think that's where I had it right when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow, we're starting this. Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, maybe if I had grown up a male, I would have had the same response. But I think it's just hard to put yourself in the situation and imagine. It's already bad enough to know what condition you've had, but then to look at somebody else's and like, that you don't know how to deal with, you know? I mean.
Similar to when I'm cross-dressed in Halloween a couple times. Mm-hmm. And have to wear a bra and heels.
Yeah. Some of us didn't last too long with that either. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the stuff that comes with the territory, most of us on either camp are like, forget it. Not for me. Oh my gosh. Let's see if we missed anything from what she had.
We did have a comment online.
Yeah.
Kind of along with what you were saying, if you asked a small child to imagine being out of sex, you know, how would they respond to not having a lifetime of that learned behavior?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so much that.
Or to see how acculturated at an early age it already is.
Oh, yeah.
To be blown away by that.
Should we repeat the question so that people can hear it?
Comment.
Yeah, go ahead and say it again and I'll.
I think if you asked a small child to imagine being the other sex, it would be much easier because they don't have a lifetime of learning behavior.
So we had a comment from somebody that said, I think if you ask a small child what it would be like to be the other sex, it would be easier because they don't have all the years of conditioning that we have. Yeah.
I mean, I really identify as wanting boys' freedom.
Mm, you wanted boys' freedom when you were young.
Yeah, 7, 8, 9, man, I really wanted what they had.
Mm. Yeah, you grew up in the South. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never really had that. I was playing, I had a whole football uniform when I was in elementary school. Helmet, knee pads, shoulder pads, the whole thing. And what was funny about that really is that my mom was not into any sports and very much, you know, like a sorority girl. When I was throwing out stuff, she wouldn't let me throw out that football helmet. You know, I really think my mom raised me in a way to think I could just do anything. And so I didn't, you know, have that. And that was really cute. Okay. But did we become aware of our strong identity in the course of all of this? We're very identified with that. And it's all a whole label based on the arrangement of the molecules in our body. Look at the identities we've created. Wow, they spin off into like so many different things. Products, school systems, you know, bathroom design, labels on bathrooms. Vocabulary.
Today, I don't know how I got on this, but this scientific test of vocabulary words that men recognize and that women recognize, was there a difference? And there was quite a list, like men, 86% of men know what solenoid means, whereas only 15% of the women tested, or 15, you know, 86% of the women knew what wisteria was, where only 10% of the men knew what it was, so So they work in a science mechanics.
So men are on Mars and women are on Venus when it comes to language,
that's
too.
This particular test was illustrated.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just it starts early and it never stops.
Yeah.
Colors, shapes, products, everything. It's crazy. Yeah, I made a big identity out of that. Let's see what else they have in here. Yeah, it's funny. Not too much new. It's just that it's funny to me that they say, from the commentary from the verse, which is verse 227, it says, when all the elements do not have male, female, or neuter gender, how can the inner self, which relies on the outer self, those elements feasibly be male, female, or neuter? It cannot. If all the elements were male, female, or neuter, it would follow that even during the early stages of the fetus, maleness and so forth should be observable. It's funny to me that they had such a knowledge of this, but I realized a lot of times when you read these Buddhist texts, they were, I think they didn't have the thing that they had in some other countries. Remember in Germany, it was a big thing when they started doing autopsies on bodies and everything. It was kind of not allowed, and I don't think that was the way in India. I think they were in the charnel grounds.
You're talking about bodies
up. They saw the parts. They're very familiar. They're much more familiar with the anatomy than at a much earlier time in history, from what I can see. Okay. Number four. How would you refute Joe Blow's contention that the self is permanent and is the one entering and leaving samsara? And if there is no self, who is in samsara due to karma, and who would gain liberation? So Joe Blow is saying that the self is permanent and it's what enters and leaves samsara.
But is it logical for the self to be permanent and a separate entity from the body, because the person, like the body, changes from one rebirth to another, for example, like from human to animal?
So it's illogical for the person. Say that again. It's illogical for the person.
For the self to be permanent.
For the self to be permanent and separate entity from the body.
Because the person, like the body, changes from one rebirth to another.
Because the person, like the body, changes from one rebirth to another.
So, like from, you could change from human to animal.
Yeah, you could be a human in one life and an animal in another life.
The permanent self cannot be the cause of entering and.
Yeah, so that shoots out the permanence. So then, how could the permanent self enter and leave samsara?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did other people have ideas?
Or create karma.
How could a permanent self create karma?
Yeah, suffer.
How could a permanent self suffer? Yeah, it wouldn't suffer. Venerable said if they were in the hell realms, why would they suffer? They don't change.
Mm-hmm. They would be suffering eternally.
Or they would be suffering eternally. It would be one or the other. Continually,
And then the other one on this, that other course that says who would gain liberation, is that...
Who would gain liberation?
This whole idea that a permanent self could be liberated because a liberator one has to abandon the ignorance that grasps at the permanent self.
Yeah. How could a permanent self be liberated when the permanent self has got to abandon self-grasping and eliminates the self? They get into that more down the line here, big time.
Yeah.
They just touch on it here, but some of these questions overlap now.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other school, the bad guys, they're asserting a self that has its own entity. And so anyone who saw that self should call it I. You know, it's like, that doesn't work. Because something that has its own entity is that. It doesn't depend on being labeled that. It just is that. So it doesn't exist in a relationship to anything else, like what we were saying. That self wouldn't change from life to life. There's a lot more on this one, but let me go before I forget. There were some things in here that I wanted to mention. Okay, one thing here says, because this is so well written, it's very coherent. So one thing in here that kind of talked to this question, non-Buddhists who assert a permanent, unitary, and independent self falsely conceive of the self as unchanging, as not arising and ceasing. They believe that the self or soul is not born and does not die. Eternal and unchanging, it's beyond life and death. To counteract this wrong view of the self, we must understand the impermanence of the self, which is the opposite of this wrong view. Permanent means something does not change from one moment to the next. It's unconditioned in that it is not produced by causes and conditions. Examples are unobstructed space, selflessness, and emptiness. Impermanent means that something changes under the influence of causes and conditions. Together, impermanent and permanent comprise all existence. And that kind of sets kind of like the basic ideas. Someone who believes that the person who that doesn't rely on arising and disintegrating rejects both the coarse and subtle impermanence of the person. She believes that there's an unchanging soul that does not arise at the time of birth and does not change, at least at the time of death. Is it possible for such a permanent static person to exist? When we examine the person, you, me, or any of us, we see that we change in every split second. The person does not remain for a second moment after arising. The person exists within moment by moment arising and disintegration. This is the person's subtle impermanence. The separation of the person's body and mind at the time of death is the person's coarse impermanence. So you're also getting rid of subtle and coarse impermanence. Which is like, that doesn't work. That's another way to refute their... Let's see what else we had here. Well, one of the verses says, 229, from one rebirth to another, the person changes like the body. It's illogical for yours to be separate from the body and permanent. I think that's what she said. So that's, the self can't be permanent because the self changes. Yeah, can't, you're going to be a self, a human one, God, next, the realms, that doesn't work. Yeah, we did that. Taking rebirth involves change. And then there's a thing about why bother to, there's a, one verse that's kind of in the same area that relates to this topic. It's like, why would you bother to teach nonviolence and wonder about, why teach nonviolence and wonder about conditions for a permanent self? A diamond never has to be protected against woodworm. So, like, why would you even deal with the topic if the self is permanent? It'd be like immaterial. Do you understand why? It's like if the thing about a diamond. Well, let me explain it the way she does. Like these beings, as we said, that are permanent. Even if they were in the hell realms, if they weren't experiencing pain before, they wouldn't experience it there, so there's no suffering there. There's nothing that could harm this kind of permanent self, because it's not changing moment by moment. So it couldn't be adversely affected by lower rebirth, so then why would you bother to keep good ethical conduct? There'd be, you know, everything starts to fall apart. It makes you very nihilistic. So that, these are other reasons, because that was kind of the question, I think, is what are the reasons that you kind of blow apart the permanent. And then another verse says, how can that which is permanent be harmed or unharmed be liberated? Liberation is irrelevant for one whose self is permanent. And I think we've, yeah, and also it would be impossible to attain it. I think we've hit all the points. Nothing can harm a permanent functioning thing. And that's why they say, just as a diamond, which is not in danger of being harmed, is against this woodworm, you know, that's how that fits in. A diamond would be unharmed, just as a permanent self would. And then the other thing that I wanted to bring up here, although it goes into the next questions, but we'll just touch on it. It kind of goes into the next one, too, but I kind of laid it out here, is who? Who would gain liberation? So it would be the person. So who's the person? Well, it kind of depends on which school you ask. So we'll just do a little review here because it's interesting. So in the Great Exposition School, it would be the mere collection of the mental and physical aggregates.
Yeah.
That's kind of hard. Not all of them. You know, they put all those 18 schools together. Not all of them have exactly that. But how could that work? Your physical aggregates going from life to life? I don't think so. And then the Sutra school following scripture, the continuum of the aggregates is an illustration of the person, which means it is the person. That still doesn't work. It's kind of the same problem as the last one. The Sutra school following reasoning assert that the person is a subtle, neutral type of mental consciousness because this consciousness exists continuously throughout deep sleep, during meditative equipoise, and from lifetime to lifetime. So they're saying it's a consciousness. The mind only following scripture say it's the mind basis of all, or the alaya. And then the mind only following reasoning say it's the mental consciousness is the illustration of the person or is the person. And they qualify that and they say it's the mental consciousness that is the actual person is a subtle neutral form of the mental consciousness which exists unceasingly throughout the whole life. And then you've got the middle way school, so you've got the Svatantrika autonomy school, and for both the yogic autonomous and the sutra autonomous, they say a neutral, subtle mental consciousness. That's the illustration of the person. And then the consequence school, what do they say? The mere eye. Very good. A person is the mere eye that is imputed in dependence upon its basis of imputation. In the consequence system, a person is the dependently imputed eye, not the mental consciousness, nor the composite of aggregates, nor a mind basis of all. Okay, so that kind of leads us into the next question. So we've now refuted, having refuted Joe Blow above, how do you explain how a person is reborn in samsara under the influence of karma and can attain liberation? Who is in samsara and who attains liberation? So how do you explain how a person is reborn into samsara and attains liberation? She talked about this. It was all over the place, though, in the teachings. I mean, it was scattered from A to Z.
Say a little bit.
Yeah.
So if we look at the time of death, craving arises in our mind due to our ignorance. Mm-hmm. So we crave to remain in our body or remain in this life.
Mm-hmm.
This craving acts as a water and fertilizer on some of our karmic latencies, which is really residual energy left on the mind stream when an action has been completed. When these latencies mature, they influence what we experience. And the latencies most likely to ripen are the ones that we have, the ones where we have a complete virtuous or non-virtuous action.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time of death, if we have a lot of craving, a lot of holding on to this life, a lot of anger, a lot of regret, those kinds of things, then that mind state acts as a fertilizer for negative latency to ripen, and we're born in cyclic existence, perhaps in a lower realm.
Mm.
If we die with craving, but with a virtuous mind, we again will be reborn in cyclic existence, but maybe in an upper rebirth. So we're reborn again and again and again in this way without end, as long as ignorance is there, because it's the root of samsara. And also, this I think I got from Alex's.
So the first idea, let me just say, in case I couldn't hear, is a very good explanation of kind of what happens in the 12 links in terms of how at the time of death, craving arises. And what arises at the time of death in the mind stream is going to direct, if you have ripening of a karma that's going to throw your next rebirth, it will depend on what's ripening in your mind then. So it could be virtuous, sending you to upper realms, it could be non-virtuous, sending you to lower realms. There's more, but that's the basic gist. I actually think people can hear some of this.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, because when I listen to them, they usually do. So speak loud, though.
Okay. And then also, Buddhism asserts that a mental continuum must always have a physical basis. It needs a support. So on the grossest level, a physical body is needed as a support for a mental continuum. The support, however, doesn't create what is supported on it.
So Buddhism asserts that a mental continuum always needs a physical basis, but the basis doesn't create it. The mental consciousness that rides with it.
So when a particular body stops functioning and can no longer support a particular mental continuum, Buddhism explains that this mental continuum continues with a different physical basis. First a subtle one and then another gross body.
So basically at death you lose the gross physical body, but you have a more subtle physical basis.
To go with the very, very subtle mind.
The mental continuum does not simply end when its present physical support stops functioning, because the physical support of a mental continuum is not the cause for the mental continuum to continue. So why I like this is that he really speaks a lot about how something follows what was there previously. Mm. That's the continuum piece. And it always follows. And that's, for me, that's helpful to understand the separation from body and mind. I will say that.
What follows what?
Well, like if we think about moments of mind, you know, what creates the next moment of mind is the previous one. It's not something the body's doing. In that way.
Okay.
So it has to be. What would be the word? It has to be congruent, I guess.
Yeah, so I think I'd like to read these things from Kinzer Jompa Tekchok, because this is a very difficult question in a way. And he makes a really good distinction here that I would rather get right, so I'll read these things from him. So there's a few of them. I have to say my organization is just collecting stuff. It's not necessarily getting it in the right order. So you have to put up with that. Okay, so I'm going to read some things from Insight into Emptiness that relate to this question. Having refuted Joe Blow, how do you explain how a person is reborn in samsara under the influence of karma and can attain liberation? Because this points to some of the things that Venerable Jignani was speaking about. Who is in samsara and who attains liberation? So here's some things that relate to this. Now, wandering in cyclic existence, born again and again in the six realms, is not something that we have any choice about. It's not as if we make up our minds, I think I'll be reborn this rebirth, or I want to be reborn in this family. It doesn't work like that. We are born in the various realms of cyclic existence as a result of karma. Due to destructive karma created in the past, we are born in the unfortunate realms. Due to constructive karma, we are born in the fortunate realms, which is very much like what Venerable Jigme was saying. He goes on to say there are 84,000 afflictions described in the Buddhist scriptures. These can be summarized in the six root and 20 auxiliary afflictions, and all of these can further be condensed into the three poisons of attachment, anger, and confusion, which is another way of explaining what Venerable Jigme was talking about. But the root of all afflictions and karma, the foundation upon which all the cyclic existence rests, the one that causes all rebirth, is self-grasping ignorance, also called ignorance grasping at true existence. Thus, if we want to be free of all dukkha and rebirth and cyclic existence, we need to eradicate their root, ignorance. The way to do that is through the direct and non-conceptual realization of emptiness, and this can free us. So now we see the importance of learning, thinking, and meditating on emptiness, because our very well-being and happiness depends on this. If we want to remove a tree, we must do so by removing its root. Just trimming the branches won't achieve our purpose. In the same way, if we want to get rid of cyclic existence once and for all, we must eliminate its root, self-grasping ignorance. Once we eliminate that ignorance, all the afflicted thoughts and emotions derived from it, such as attachment, anger, jealousy, and pride, will also be eliminated. If we remove those afflictions, it's no longer possible to create karma motivated by them. Without afflictions and karma, rebirth and cyclic existence is no longer possible. The entire structure on which our continued misery is built can be abolished by the means of the wisdom realizing emptiness of inherent existence. This state of freedom from cyclic existence is called liberation. We will also attain true cessation and nirvana. And the difference between this is liberation is posited from the viewpoint of the being free from dukkha of cyclic existence and unfortunate realms. True cessation is posited from the viewpoint of ceasing the causes that impel us to experience the dukkha of cyclic existence and fortunate rebirths. And nirvana is posited from the viewpoint of having gone beyond the dukkha of samsara and unfortunate realms along with their causes. So nirvana is also translated as the state beyond sorrow. And this sorrow is referring to the afflicted thoughts and emotions as well as the dukkha of cyclic existence. The non-conceptual realization of emptiness is known as the actual refuge because it completely eliminates the root of cyclic existence, the self-grasping ignorance. When the foundation of cyclic existence has been destroyed, everything that depends on that foundation, the afflictions, karma, also crumble. That gives us one view. And then there's a little bit more, and then it gets into something that is quite important. Okay, the view of the perishing aggregates is said to be the root of cyclic existence. It's one type of self-grasping of persons. Self-grasping of persons refers to grasping at any person, ourselves or other, as truly existent, while the view of the perishing aggregates, or the view of personal identity, grasps only at our own self as truly existence. So there's this view is of two types, where the view of the perishing aggregates grasping at I, and the view of the perishing aggregates grasping at mine. Both of these are the forms of self-grasping, and they grasp at their object as existing in a way that is precisely opposite to the way in which it actually exists. And it's called this the view of the perishing aggregates because the I is merely labeled in dependence upon the aggregates, and the aggregates arise and cease every moment. And then one very important point we're getting to. It takes a little bit more. In the Ocean of Reasoning, Lama Tsongkhapa states concisely that only non-Buddhist systems assert a person that is a different entity from the aggregates and that remains after the aggregates are gone. That's like a soul. Yeah. No Buddhist system asserts a discrete self or soul. Remembering this is helpful as our investigation of emptiness continues. Another point to keep in mind while studying this topic is that apart from the Prasangika system, all other Buddhist systems assert that the person is found among the aggregates. Only the Prasangika say the person is not found at all, either as a separate entity from the aggregates or within the aggregates that are its basis of imputation. Nevertheless, they assert a theory of agents, actions, and objects on the basis of everything being mere name and mere imputation. So this gets us to the next part, which is like, is it the consciousness that goes that we're asserting here? No, it's actually not the consciousness, even though that's what we've been talking about. It's a merely labeled person. And so this is a part that, I think it's on this one. Could have been in the next question, and we'll see if we get to the part I'm thinking about. I thought it was this next thing, but maybe not. It might be the next. Whatever, we'll see. The continuity of mental consciousness goes from one life to the next. It's an ever-changing flow of moments. When trying to identify the person, examine the relationship between the person and the aggregates by looking for the person within the aggregates, we discover that the person exists through depending on the aggregates. In fact, the person is merely imputed in dependence on the aggregates. It is not the aggregates themselves. Thus, do not think that when we search for the person in the aggregates, that is, when we try to find something in the aggregates that can be identified as the person, we find the continuity of mental consciousness. Yeah, let me say that again. Thus, do not think that when we search for the person in the aggregates, that is, when we try to find something in the aggregates that can be identified as being the person, we find the continuity of mental consciousness is the person. Rather, when we seek the person, we see there is no self-existent person at all. An inherently existent person does not exist. It's only merely labeled person. So I guess what I'm looking for is in the next one. It's not the mental consciousness, but it's labeled independence on.
The mere I is the illustration of the person, and the basis of designation of that mere I is the continuity.
Right. But let me find, I got to find this piece. I guess it's in the next question. It's how karmic seeds are carried life to life. So I'm just going to read this because I want to find this one point because, yeah, I guess I put it with that one.
There's also a piece from Venerable's teachings on this that said that the person in samsara is a generality.
Yeah. Yes.
Which needs a term to describe the continuity of mind that covers the past self, the present self, yep, and the future self.
Yep.
It's not a fixed identity that exists with its own nature, but is a generality referring to all the different selves, all the different lives, and the different moments. The person's merely labeled and depends upon these continuities that have no fixed inheriting system, that she goes into some more wonderful descriptions about that.
Okay, here's the part I'm looking for. the illustration of the person, the mere eye, and the continuity of mental consciousness. This is the part that has a distinction that's hard. He says right here, this is very difficult to understand. I myself found it very confusing, but listening to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama's teachings many times has made it clearer. I'd like to review this point to help you understand. So here's what he says. How do the Prasangikas say that the mere eye is this illustration of the person? To make the point that the person is not found when searched for in the aggregates, the mere in mere eye negates the same thing that is negated when we say merely imputed by conception or merely labeled. It negates existing from its own side. Saying that the mere eye is the person eliminates any of the aggregates being the person. It gives the idea that the person is not findable among the aggregates. Nevertheless, the mere eye and the person are one nature because the mere eye is the illustration of the person. So that's the thing that's hard for us to kind of grok. The mere eye and the person are one nature, but they're not the same thing. The mere eye is the eye that is merely imputed in dependence on the continuity of mental consciousness, because the mental consciousness is what goes from life to life into awakening. The Prasangikas say that the mere eye this is the important point. The Prasangikas say that what the mere eye refers to is the continuity of the mental consciousness. This is very different from what other schools that say that the continuity of mental consciousness is the illustration of the person, where they're saying it refers to it. This is the big distinction here. Because those other systems also assert that when you search for the person in the aggregates, you'll find the continuity of mental consciousness. So when we read that list, they could say all this, there are variations of mental consciousness, and boom, you get the Prasangika. It's no.
What page is it?
This is on page 80. So we'll just finish this part and then end. It is in the context of searching for the person in the aggregates and finding the continuity of the mental consciousness that they lay claim that the continuity of mental consciousness to be the illustration of the person. The Prasangika do not agree. They maintain that when you search for the person in the aggregates, you cannot find anything that is the person. Thus, while they say that what the mere eye refers to is the continuity of the mental consciousness, they do not say that the continuity of the mental consciousness is the illustration of the person. So that's an important distinction for that system. I think it's made that clear enough. So we've mostly finished that question, although we haven't really answered it the way that it was asked exactly. So we'll finish that now, and then we'll end at this question. So the way that this was taught, the answer is kind of the same, but it was explained different. We have explained how a person is reborn into and out of samsara and who can attain liberation. It's a merely labeled person, a dependent person, an impersonal person that exists just in dependence on the body and the mind. And that's the kind of person that exists, and there's nothing beyond that. So the Prasangikas aren't saying that a person is totally non-existent. They're just saying there's not an inherently existent person, because that doesn't exist anywhere. And so one thing that Venerable Children said here that I think is helpful for us is, it's off the topic but on the topic. Lama Zopa would say, how do you realize emptiness? You see things just barely exist. Just because there's the thought, it just barely exists. So that doesn't mean if we stop thinking about things, they stop existing. That's not what he's saying. But what exists exists dependent on conception and name. So
it's not wrong to say, who is in samsara? I am.
Yeah, you are in samsara.
Merely labeled.
Yeah,
I am.
Yeah, the merely labeled. You have to, actually, sometimes they say there's no self, and sometimes they say there is a self. So you have to see where they're coming from. Let's see if we really answered all these things. I think we kind of did. Yeah, we did say the point that how crazy it would be if the chief affliction you're getting rid of is the grasping at the self, and then you're saying the self doesn't exist. You know, like there's no self there. I mean, so there has to be some kind of self. To say that you're refuting a self that doesn't exist and at the same time asserting a permanent self that's left over that attains nirvana is ridiculous. Because that's kind of what happens with the permanent self. If you say it's like Joe Blow says, there's a permanent self that gets to nirvana, well, then you've just refuted that self, and now you don't have a self left. That was kind of their problem. They couldn't understand that if you they were just refuting an inherently existent self, there was still something left over. So we can't find any causeless self that doesn't depend on the aggregates. Yeah, I think we answered that. Let's see, one more page. What's on here? Oh yeah. So yeah, we've kind of said this is, she's just saying it in another way. So this person that's thinking that when the Madhyamakas are saying there's no person at the time of liberation, they're not making the distinction. Madhyamakas are saying there's no inherently existent person. And they're thinking, oh, you're saying there's no person at all. So the Madhyamakas say, no, we're just destroying, what we've destroyed destroys all self-grasping and afflictions. And they think, oh, you're destroying everything that's impermanent. This is kind of where they go, because they think the person has to be permanent to have a continuum. That gets into one of the last questions. They have a lot of difficulty with understanding continuums. Yeah, so if people believe there's a permanent self at the time of liberation and you disprove the existence of that permanent self, then they're going to think, oh, there's no self whatsoever. So that's true. There isn't a self that exists under its own power. And then she got into a couple other little things. If the self existed by its own entity, then it should be seen in the state of nirvana. Yeah, and we've already seen there's a fear that because they don't see that, so that's gone. And once this life is disintegrated, it's gone. The person of this life no longer exists. There's only the continuity of this person. And I think that actually in the next question, this will explain a little bit more about the terminology of the general I and the specific I. That's one way to answer it. So I think we'll stop here. We got through question 5.
Good job.
It might take 3 weeks. But what we should do is we should be ready on that third week for the next quiz. And I'm not sure if they're on. Are they online? 11 and 12? Does anybody know? There is a quiz 11 and 12, and we'll, for anyone who's listening, and we'll get them up online. The next week or so will be on chapter 10, and then the chapter 11 is the one all about time. So let's put this back into the context of our motivation and think about letting go of this crazy mind, these crazy conceptions that we have, that we find the need to protect ourselves for the smallest little things that come up, and see how, if we're having so much trouble in our life here, how about people that are in just amazing situations? 50 million refugees. 7 billion people, 50 million, what is that, 14, 1/28 of the population, maybe? Or was it 1/14 of the population? It's 1/14 of the population. If it's 50 million, that's half of a billion. There's 7 billion.
It's half of 100 million.
Yeah. Anyway,
right.
Too many. So let's make prayers for these efforts to be a benefit to all beings. May we become enlightened and have connections with all beings and help them to be free of every suffering. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, May you stay until samsara ends. Peerless Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Thupten, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in the glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, flourish.